Hello, I am your noble, robotic, introducer, and this is the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Welcome to episode 2021.03.00. This podcast is being published on Sunday, February 21st, 2021. If you would like a copy of today's episode, download it for free at radio, the number 4. ALL.net. That's radio, the number 4. ALL.net. You can also download episodes from iTunes, Google Podcast, and Anchor.fm. You can reach out to your host if you have any questions at radio, the number 4. ALL.net and Anchor.fm. Today's episode title is Will Biden Mimic Buchanan, Hoover or the Weimar Social Democrats? Now on with the episode.
Why exactly is this man the worst president ever? Hey, what's up? My name's Justin with Infuse Library. If you're anything like me, you probably find today's politics depressing and chaotic. And if I stopped someone on the street right now asking them who the worst president was, many people would probably name one of the last four or five presidents as the worst ever. So with such a good selection of questionable presidents to choose between, why do so many historians point to this guy as the worst president ever? I bet you don't even know his name. Now, James is an unlikely fellow to get this terrible award, if I'm being honest. Just take a look at his resume before he became president. Let's see. Military experience? Check. Lawyer? Check. Congressman in the House of Representatives? Check. Senator? Check. U.S. emissary to Russia? Check. Brokers a trade deal between the two countries? Check. U.S. emissary to England? Check again. Senator again? Check. Secretary of State? Check. Mr. Buchanan's resume, on paper at least, was so impressive that you'd probably think he was the most qualified man in the entire country to even run for office. And you'd probably be right. The man had done practically everything, and with his political connections, he knew everyone worth knowing, especially in the South. And if you think about it, who better to calm the tensions between the two halves of the country but a Northerner with Southern sympathies? He knows how the government works, deep knowledge of the law, has friends in all the right places, and has a plan to save us from civil war. What a guy. But the final piece of the puzzle that tipped the election into his favor was the fact that he was just out of country during some really turbulent political debates. He never had to form a controversial political opinion on some of the really big hot topics of the day. While he was off busy being a political ambassador to England, hobnobbing with leaders of other countries, his political opponents were back home, self-destructing and getting their hands dirty over issues that divided the country. And because of all this, even though he wasn't necessarily the most famous man in the country that could have run for president, he appeared to be the better choice to the average American voter. So where the heck does all this go wrong? And what led one historian to say that Buchanan came closer to committing treason than any other president in American history? To explain all this, we should probably get to know James a little bit. On the good side, James was great at throwing parties. While that's really funny to say, it was actually a really useful skill. He was a people person that made friends relatively easily. This skill really served him well while being a diplomat in various countries. He was also a very generous guy, constantly helping out friends, family, and the poor. James Buchanan was peace-minded. He tried so many times to stop the Civil War from happening, and did prevent the USA from getting into a war with the British. Even though he was pro-slavery in law, he once bought some slaves in Washington to free them in Pennsylvania. If we took James Buchanan and put him in a more peaceful era of history, he might have escaped the historical criticism that he eventually got, and he would just end up being like a footnote, another average president not worth mentioning. The man even kept a pair of bald eagles as pets, which is awesome. But he unfortunately also had a lot of negative traits which led him to being a pretty bad president. James really wanted to please everyone, which is why he was so good at throwing parties. But unfortunately, being a people pleaser is just something you can't be while a president of the United States. Also had the tendency to flip-flop on really important decisions, and he would also contradict himself often. Another problem was that he worked really hard to appease southern states, even when doing so hurt the whole country. And finally, he just straight up didn't do things when everything was on the line. He was prone to inaction during crucial moments of American history. With the country slowly dissolving into civil war before his very eyes, Buchanan faced some really tough situations that would have challenged the very best of presidents. And it actually did, his successor, Abraham Lincoln. 1856, Election Day. James becomes the 15th president of the United States. And wouldn't you know it, just 2 days in, he suddenly has an influence over the trial of the century, Dred Scott v. Sanford. In case you're rusty on this case, let me give you a really simplified version of what happened. The whole case centers on this man, Dred Scott. He was an enslaved African American. He was taken from Missouri, his home state, which happened to be a slave state, by his owners into Missouri Territory, a free area. When his owners later brought him back to the state of Missouri from the free territory, Scott sued for his freedom. He said that he was legally no longer a slave because he had entered a free area. He started the lawsuit in the Missouri State Court, but eventually went all the way up to the Supreme Court, thus affecting the entire country. What a great opportunity to move forward as a country and start the process away from slavery, right? Well, no. Unfortunately, they took the exact opposite approach. The case was actually thrown out because it was decided that, number one, the case had no grounds. Number two, due to the color of his skin, he wasn't a citizen and never could be. Number three, because of this, he had no right to sue anyone in court. He, in fact, didn't have any rights. And finally, number four, just for good measure, one of the judges said that the Missouri Compromise was a load of BS because it limited slavery and exceeded Congress's powers under the Constitution. Now, of course, this is all greatly simplifying the whole thing, but I'm sure you're wondering what the heck this has to do with our brand new two-day-old president. Well, he actually influenced the court in that decision. He wanted them to make a definitive statement on the issue to solve it. He didn't single-handedly make it happen, of course, but he did influence it. Not a good look for a president. James was so naive that he said this case would permanently settle the issue of slavery. He would later find out that this case just made the situation worse. The South thought it was amazing, and the North thought it was terrible. It strengthened the Republican Party because now they had an issue to fight for, and then split the Democratic Party in two. This one case was a leading cause of the Civil War, and we're only 2 days into his presidency. Let's take a look at another crisis that happened, something delightfully called the Panic of 1857. This was a financial panic that wiped out 1,400 state banks and 5,000 businesses. As with all financial panics, the root causes were pretty complex, stemmed from a declining U.S. and international economy, a gold shipment via the SS Central America sank, making the situation worse, and then overspeculation handled the rest. Although the effects of this were pretty short, it was devastating to big swaths of the country. Interestingly enough, this was only a heavy blow to the North. The southern economy was mostly farm-based and escaped most of the damage. So the country looks to the president to see if he has a solution to this mini recession. And President Buchanan took the bold stance that, number one, anyone who lost money did it to themselves by overspeculating, and number two, better luck next time. He withdrew all banknotes under $20 to reduce inflation. He then issued a statement to the state banks, basically some advice. And that was pretty much it. As you'll see a lot here, he took the hands-off approach. His motto was reform over relief. This was a first look at one of President Buchanan's tendencies, just sitting around and doing nothing during times of national crisis. Okay, so that was a pretty busy first year, but now it's time to move ahead to one of the most questionable parts of his presidency. James really, really wanted Kansas to be a state. There was Minnesota in 1858, Oregon in 1859, and then finally Kansas in 1861. But one reason why he was particularly eager for Kansas to become a state was that, in all likelihood, it would probably end up being pro-Democrat, which of course was the political party he was a member of. But the main obstacle was that Kansas, politically, was kind of a mess. There wasn't one unified territorial government. And instead of restarting Kansas under one unified territorial government, President Buchanan just decided to back one of the factions, the pro-slavery Lecompton government. And by backing them, I mean that he tried to rush the Lecompton Constitution to be recognized by Congress. But the issue was that there was also a rival Topeka government that voted against the Lecompton Constitution. But James didn't really care about the popular will of the people, though. He pushed the Lecompton Constitution through Congress, offering favors, patronage, appointments, and even cash for votes. James Buchanan was straight up bribing his way through Congress to pass this darn bill. Not a good look for a president. Unfortunately for James, though, it only got halfway through Congress before being rejected by the House of Representatives, though it did pass through the Senate. His efforts at trying to bribe Congress didn't go unnoticed, though. There was a movement to actually get him impeached. It didn't really go anywhere though, especially because he only promised to serve for one term. So as you've probably noticed, the issue that stalked him his entire term was the North-South unrest. I'm not exactly sure if he could have done anything to stop it from happening, but he sure helped it speed along. James didn't necessarily do one thing that made him into the worst president ever. It was a series of decisions that just showed that he didn't really know what the heck was going on and how his actions were affecting the entire country. One really quick example of this was the fact that he was eager for John Brown to be hanged, which just ended up making John Brown into a martyr for the abolitionist cause, creating more strife. But even more concerningly, Buchanan knew that the southern states were attempting to break away, and he didn't take any action to stop it from happening. In his final speech to Congress, with the eyes of the country on him, James went out of his way to say the worst things possible. He mentioned that the states did not have the right to break away from the country. And then he immediately said that if they did break away, he and the whole federal government didn't have the constitutional right to stop them from doing it. He then blamed the northern states for the whole crisis because he said, by interfering with slavery, they caused the whole problem. His solution to all this was to suggest that Congress amend the Constitution, affirming slavery, setting in stone the fugitive state laws, and popular sovereignty in the territories. The South hated it because he said that they couldn't secede, and the North hated it because he said he wouldn't stop the South from seceding, practically inviting them to do so. I don't want to give the impression that James wasn't trying to stop the inevitable. He was actively attempting to make the southern states happy and negotiate with them time and time again. His main technique was to try to say that we could pass a slavery amendment to the Constitution to put the law on the side of the southern states. But none of that worked, no law was passed, and even if it was passed, it wouldn't have fixed the situation. Despite all of his efforts, state after state began to secede. And Buchanan actually had to replace some of his cabinet members as this was happening because they were actually from the states that broke away. So all of this brings us to Fort Sumter. This is a very, very important fort in the Civil War because it kind of just started it. Deep in Confederate territory, it became clear that it would eventually be taken by the southern states. Now, it's possible that the Union could have held on to this very important fort. The problem is, President Buchanan didn't send any extra troops to fortify the fort until it was too late. Every day that he didn't send more troops and supplies, the problem got worse. He actually thought about surrendering the fort before it was even attacked, but then his brand new cabinet members that just signed on threatened to resign, so James decided not to. When he finally did send a ship with men and supplies, it was forced away by the Confederates. It was too late. Interestingly enough, Buchanan did not react to this form of aggression as an act of war and just continued to negotiate. But the crazy thing here is that right before the situation finally reached its boiling point, right before shots were fired, his presidential term was up, and a relieved ex-President Buchanan finally left the White House. This video was inspired by the book Worst President Ever. If you want a more detailed look at the entire life of James Buchanan, I highly recommend it.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers, if you want to say there's no wars, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Rabbi Adis. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. Throughout American history, there have been two presidents, James Buchanan and Herbert Hoover, who arguably made decisions and took actions and often inactions and missteps which plunged the United States into a deeper crisis. Now, it would be unfair to say that they themselves alone should be blamed for the crises, but they became, if you look at their time in the White House, they almost became personifications of the country's ineptitude, at least amongst the elite, to stop the nation as a whole from entering what turned out to be historically shattering, distorting, and generationally consequential circumstances. Buchanan, who was the president immediately preceding the Civil War, who seemed to not really take seriously the looming threat of secession and the strain that slavery and the trafficking of slaves throughout the United States, the trapping of slaves in non-slave states and territories, just what that was doing to America, American life, and how the political stress of those two competing realities had brought the country to the brink of disaster. If the South had been a little bit more technologically advanced, they would have probably defeated the North, because the North, in its arrogance, wasn't really ready for a war. They weren't ready for a war. And again, Buchanan gets, and I think deserves, a lot of discredit for that. The same goes with Herbert Hoover. Now, in the case of Buchanan, his inactions, and really the president, the two presidents that came before him also, but Buchanan specifically did not take serious the threat that was apparent when he walked into the White House, and only became more so as his tenure continued. His decision, more so than even the ending of Jim Crow, his decision to not see history as it was unfolding, to not see that his inactions would be so damnifying, that by not just dealing forthright with the collective issue of freedom and not freedom, he was setting a trap for the United States to have to deal with that question of free and not free for the next 100 years and more. This inability to deal with that fundamental question didn't end with Buchanan's retirement from the office. Abe Lincoln, even though he's widely praised for finally coming to the correct assumption and the correct conclusion, Abe Lincoln pretty much took up the same approach that Buchanan did, and refused even as the Civil War began and was underway, to concede the fact that it was the fundamental question in the American character of whether or not freedom meant freedom. You cannot have freedom for a few if you believe it is limited. Because then, at any given time, you, who are part of the few, could become one of the non-free by dint of actions that you took. And if you look at the labor wars in the United States, which is what they really should be called, these were labor wars. People literally died. This was combat for corporations. You saw the principles that was applied to African slaves. Now, I'm not putting the two on the same footing, because a lot of white union members didn't support full liberation for black people. They didn't. So I can't put them on the same pedestal, but I can say that idea of some being free and some being less free or non-free became evident that there was always going to be this middle ground of less free when it came to white people. It became evident during the labor wars. But I don't want to get off subject here, so I'm going to leave that alone, because this is important. We have just inaugurated a president, Joe Biden, who I believe has history stirring around him. And I don't know if he knows it. Buchanan's inactions literally impacted the United States past its bicentennial. And some might even say, I'd be one of them, that it still impacts us today. The fact that he didn't want to wrestle with the fundamental questions of freedom. The fact that even going all the way back, today we celebrate Hamilton, who we shouldn't. Even going all the way back to George Washington, they never wanted to deal with the idea of freedom. But Buchanan, looking disaster in the face the entire 4 years that he was in office, the fact that he didn't want to take seriously that disaster had consequences for the next 30 years. Now, the second president, and by the way, the reason why, the impact of Buchanan definitely goes a lot longer than the 30 years, but if you look at the trajectory, until the Plessy Doctrine was established as national law, we were still unwilling, this country was still unwilling to deal with the concept of freedom. And that's why this country could go from fighting the Civil War literally over freeing black people to the quote end of Reconstruction. And progressives abandoning black people in the South, not all, but a lot, especially the ones in political power. Not the ones necessarily associated with churches. This country could do that because it hadn't defined yet outright in statute for all to see during this new era, the post-Civil War era, which was supposed to be a fight over this concept. It wasn't. It was a fight over economies. But until that idea came down from the Supreme Court that separate but equal was fine, knowing darn well that it wasn't going to be equal. That defined the American character. And so, you know, I guess I could be a little bit lenient on the man and say that his influence ended when the Supreme Court picked it up in the 1890s. But no. Up until the 1960s, I'd wager his inaction was still felt until black people finally said enough is enough. Now, the second president, the second president, obviously, is Herbert Hoover. And his response to the Depression is so great that people don't even talk about it. People don't even talk about it. And I wouldn't have a clue if it wasn't for Arthur Schlesinger's book. And the book was decent, but it wasn't mind-popping, so I'm a little bit less skeptical. So I'm a little bit more skeptical. But if it wasn't for his book, I think it was called The Order Before or something like that. But Schlesinger wrote a trilogy, I think. There's three or four books on FDR, the New Deal, and what came before it, what came during it, what came after it. And that first book on what the order before FDR was very instructive, because it helped me understand that Hoover had a philosophy, and that philosophy could almost be boiled down to, the market will take care of all this. The man, you know, did some things, but it was really just down to, things are going to get better, market's going to take care of this, everything's going to be okay. And a lot of wealthy people, a lot of very wealthy people, who didn't feel the pangs and the pain of the Depression, took the same attitude. And that attitude, if we could be frank, was, I don't see the problem. I don't see the problem. Yes, you're hurting, but that's your problem, not mine. By the way, don't join radical organizations, though, because then you'll be un-American, you'll be anti-business, you'll be hurting me, and that's my problem. The selfishness in the response was evident, and the callousness of the elite was evident. And Hoover, though, you know, he wasn't unsympathetic, I suppose, to the plight of the average person, he was, I think, naive about what it would really take. Or no, let me not say what it would really take. He was naive in his understanding of how deep the Depression was and the causes, particularly internationally, of the Depression, and what his policies, which I believe, if I, you know, completely call it from memory, I think he was somewhat of an isolationist. What his policies were actually doing to injure and encourage the Depression. Capitalism had failed. Capitalism had hit a huge snag. And the inability for the wealthy to acknowledge this, the inability for Hoover to acknowledge this, played an intense role in the dislike of average peoples, especially when it became apparent that Hoover was more interested in how the businesses were doing and not how the people were doing. Sound familiar? He was Hoover. He was up until the 70s. Really responsible for the dislike of most Americans towards big business, how they viewed big business and how they viewed big business's ability to regulate the economy, to stimulate the economy, to encourage the economy. Up until the 70s, you had a lot of people, a lot of older people, who remembered the Great Depression, not because they were born during it, but because they were born way before it. And they could recall how Hoover acted. And in many cases, didn't act. And the response of the wealthy. And in many cases, the non-response of the wealthy. And what that did to the average American. And so Hoover was really the defining force. It was the baby boomers who had no idea of any of this history, and unfortunately they weren't taught it, who took the turn and said that many of the policy prescriptions that Hoover had been pushing during the Depression, which had been rebranded through various conservative channels, hey, those policies are good. Those policies should be studied and excited into existence, and they did that. Now, for me, I believe Hoover was the less impactful figure. I think Buchanan had a much broader shadow than Hoover, even though it's possible without Hoover, we might have never gotten a Franklin D. Roosevelt, because many of the prescriptions that Hoover tossed out were not new. These were prescriptions that had been laying around for pretty much the entire Industrial Revolution in the United States. And those prescriptions, I think some of them at least, not all of them, had been used partially to some extent in the 1890s. And, they came in different forms then. But the idea that if you just give them a few years, big business will lift the United States out of their economic troubles wasn't new. It wasn't new. Just as with James Buchanan, the idea of, well, there's pressure brewing over this whole freedom slavery thing, but we don't really need to deal with it now because that's a tomorrow problem. That wasn't new either. They'd been doing that since the 1770s. But the perfect storm, I know that's a cliche, I know. But really, the perfect combination of events came into existence to challenge those notions, to challenge that idea that you could just do what you had been doing. and not have any significant consequences. Well, it broke with Hoover. It broke with Hoover. And almost the counter response to that argument was FDR, was the new light, was the new vision, was the new foundation for a better America. Just as Abe Lincoln, after some time, became that for the United States. Now look, FDR had his ups and downs, so, you know, there's no purity there. But Lincoln embodied, I think, the American spirit a little bit better, a little bit more than FDR, because Lincoln literally started on the side of black people really aren't equal because, well, they're, you know, not equal naturally. So then he had to get to a point where he realized, which took a long time, that, okay, you may not respect him intellectually, but you keep this up, you ain't going to have your country. So you got to make a decision. And he made a decision for history. The same thing is true with FDR. And it is undoubtable to me, if FDR had lived another term, or his, you know, fourth term, I think FDR had made his decision in his mind that the only way that you were going to keep capitalism stable, the only way that you were going to keep the United States stable, is you were going to have to take from the private sector those things which were necessities in life. Those things that were necessities in life should be public utilities and should be owned by the municipalities, the counties, and the states. We don't even talk about those things anymore, by the way. But he had made up his mind. You could tell by his second Bill of Rights speech. Just as Lincoln had made up his mind that the United States had to be wholly free and had to have a vision forward with that idea in its mind. Unfortunately, both men died. Both men died before they could recognize those realities. Their predecessors, having completely flummoxed their responses to the burgeoning crises, their influence did not die. Buchanan's acquiescence and accommodationing or accommodationist philosophy to the South really was the beginning, you know, of the resurgence of the South after Lincoln's death. I mean, it took a minute, but it started, you see the South starting to percolate a bit after Lincoln's death. The same, as I was just pointing out a few moments ago, can be said about the disastrous philosophy of Hoover. Both of them left their mark on their prospective parties and the times to come. Now, Joe Biden, because this is where all this is leading to, Joe Biden has entered office, and it's so, man, I had this thought, and I got to give Professional Left Podcast an applause for this, because they said what I was thinking But I was so into Bernie Sanders and so disappointed about Bernie Sanders that I didn't want to acknowledge this. Joe Biden has been a horrific candidate running for office for a long time. But I also think, especially in modern times, Joe Biden has not been given the opportunity to run for president. And any of you who have heard me talk about the realities of running for president, things like that, you'll know what I'm talking about. If not, briefly, there are people who the corporate bosses want to run, and they want to see run. And there are other people who they won't stop running because, you know, this is a free system, but they'll make sure to sabotage so they don't make it. Now, with Bernie Sanders was a real insurgency. He was a real insurgent candidate. He didn't have the money, the funding, anything else to go as far as he did, but he made a way. And that's what scared these people. He was beholden to nobody. Biden, though Biden's record is pretty clear, I think, and I've had this thought fleetingly over the last year, that the wealthy didn't trust him as much as we think they did. And the reason they didn't trust him is because he's a chameleon. They concern themselves with the fact that he's such a chameleon that he could be lying. And not only is he a chameleon in the way that he could be lying, but considering the center, the nucleus of his personality, of his public persona, was Blue Collar Joe, they possibly concerned themselves with the fact that he might believe that he should be Blue Collar Joe. And if he believed he should be Blue Collar Joe, then he might enact some things that are Harry Truman-esque. Some of the positive things Harry Truman did. And they didn't want anything to do with that. They didn't want Joe Biden to go back to a time period when we could actually talk about labor unions and things like that. Now, whether or not that ends up being true, we'll see. But that was a fleeting thought that I had several times, that they just didn't trust him. Now, they've given him a ton of money now. And I think many of them expect him to do a little bit more progressive stuff because, you know, we are in such a strait. But I still think that they put him just like he was put with Barack Obama to temper Barack Obama's progressive side, I think they are concerned that Joe Biden is worrying about his legacy. I think they're concerned that Joe Biden is worried about going down as a horrible one-term president, and that may make him a little bit more ready to do some bold things. And so who do they put him with? Kamala Harris, who is not a progressive, who has built her career on, she's a Democrat, so, of course, on the bodies of poor people, black people, and brown people. So, you know, that's what they do. Now, before you come at me and say, oh, you're shilling for the Republicans, no, I'm not. No, what I'm doing is I'm calling the party what it is. If you're mad about that, look in the mirror and do something, because it's your problem, not mine. Joe Biden has history swirling around him right now. Just like you had Buchanan and you had Hoover, Joe Biden can either be Buchanan and Hoover, or he could be greater. And maybe he'll be Lincoln, where he starts off thinking, okay, I can, tweak the edges a little bit and make things fine. And then, you know, like midway through the term, say, all right, tweaking it ain't going to work. It's not working. We need to do something heavier. Let's go. Whatever he chooses, though, he's going to have to do it quickly, because he has about a year. And I'm not joking with this. He has about a year. I see the hesitancy. I feel it. I see the hesitancy in the eyes and faces and body languages of people all around me. Many of the people are very, very, very happy that Donald Trump is gone. But there is deep concern over whether or not Joe Biden's going to do what is necessary to build the economy. And here I'm not talking about young people only. I'm talking about across the board. People who are getting ready to retire, who are watching with horror the fact that Main Street is becoming desolate. Companies are closing at an alarming rate. I'm watching young people who are about to go off to college with a very strange reservation. There's optimism there, but it's not the same as it was 2 or 3 years ago. Something is different. And you know, I was thinking on this the other day, because I knew I was going to be doing this episode. And I realized that, you know, underneath the political surface, something has been broken for some time. And maybe it's as simply as just civility. Maybe it's community. The connection of one family to another. I heard Chris Hedges talking about the myth of the United States has ended. And maybe that's what's broken. And I can actually believe that, because I think the myth of capitalism is broken, and so I can believe that. The definitions that this country has grown on, they're gone. Which I can believe that. But underneath the surface of political activity, something's been broken. And we haven't wanted to face it. Now, it's likely, I know for me, it's been truth. It's been a lot of truth. It's been seeing things that I didn't want to see, seeing things that have been there, but I've been able to ignore. But something is broke. And while I don't believe it's going to be fixed in one administration, that brokenness, which was underneath the surface of political action, and truthfully, if I could be very honest, as much as people like to hate Barack Obama, Barack Obama did a lot to suture the wounds that had begun to show terribly during the George Bush administration. There was a calmness, a regalness, a strength even, that was starting to build back up throughout the community which I now live. Now, granted, where I used to live, which was in its own depressive hell, there was still that idea of regalness and strength starting to build, but the hopelessness was getting deep also. And so that brokenness, which was there below the surface of political action, Donald Trump has brought that to the top. Donald Trump has brought that to the top, and Morris Berman talked about this in an interview that he gave sometime back. I can't remember if it was the one he did in 2020 or 2018. I've listened to both a couple of times, and they're pretty good. But it's now in the open. And it didn't start with Donald Trump. It didn't start with Barack Obama. This thing has been building for a while. I truthfully go back all the way to Jimmy Carter's melee speech, where he was talking about the wounds of the 1960s and how those things had never been healed. And I really think if we want to be psychologically analytical about this society, you'd probably have to go back to there. Because that's when all of the things that made America, America, throughout the 1800s, the 1700s, into that era, that was all being challenged. That was all being done away with. And the reason it was being challenged and done away with was because it was all found to be untrue. In many senses, Democracy in Chain, really good book, the conservatism that sprung to life in the 1950s and the 1960s focused around trying to rescue these false myths. There's a book, and I haven't read it yet, it's called something like The End of the American Myth or something like that. I haven't read it yet. It's on the list of like 50 other books that I want to get read, you know, or I want to listen to while at work. And so far as I could tell, the book deals with, you know, from reading the covers and, you know, the introduction of it, the book deals with the myths coming to a head and an end this decade, which I think is apt. But I also think it misses, at least in the introduction, it may miss, and, you know, I should say may because I haven't read the book, but it may miss the whole big point, is that neoconservatism rose, even though they were disputed, but its origins are rather clear, rose in response to the New Deal, rose in the response of black people saying enough is enough, rose in the response of red people saying, yeah, you've been killing us for the last, you know, 300-400 years and not giving a darn. Well, we do care, and you're going to stop doing that. Rose in response to the fact that women, white women, because for red, brown, and black women, they had always been in the workforce. They had always been out doing what they were doing and doing it for the love of their family, doing it for the love of their communities, and not, you know, putting up the narcissistic flag and saying, look at me, I'm special because I'm out here working. You know, they just didn't do that. Now, white women were saying, enough is enough. We're not going to be second-class citizens anymore. We can go out and we can do our thing, too. More, you had on an academic and intellectual level, people saying imperialism bad, conquering other peoples because we look at them as inferior bad, hierarchical structures for racial identification bad, You know, you can still have racial ethnic identifications. You just don't have to have the hierarchy associated with it. In essence, all of these concepts that had made America what it was in the 1960s because of World War II, because you had a lot of transplants, intellectual transplants from Europe moving to the United States because it was a stable society, and becoming teachers and engineers and business people, they bought new ideas because they were intellectual misfits with the rise of Nazi nationalism, which I know it's, you know, the N is for nationalist, but still, Nazi nationalism. They bought all of that over here and begin sort of imprinting a new enlightenment onto the American character. And the neoconservatives did not like that. They didn't like the fact that all of these people, including those laboring in capitalism, with the help of labor unions and the like, they didn't like that all these people were finding their voice, that democracy was winning, that republicanism was receding. And so they went to war. They went to war with all of this new intellectual energy in order to suppress it. Their goal was to save the America that enabled them to do as they wanted to do. And what that meant was tread over black people, brown people, and red people. Treat them as trash. Make them respect them. Make black and brown and red people respect them just by seeing them. And I think even more horrific was to put white people who they deemed as trash into their right places. They didn't want the myths that had been just myths. These things had been lies. They didn't want them to end. And thus began modern corporate conservatism, neoconservatism, back in the 50s and the 60s of the 20th century. Well, we hit a wall. We have hit a wall, and those myths are crumbling. Those myths are crumbling. The question is, what's going to be done about it? And what's going to be the result from it? It is possible that before we heal this country, there's going to be some dark days. I don't want to alarm you. And that's why I waited till the end to do this. But I don't believe we're in the safe zone. You remember a few months ago, I published that episode about my fear. That fear which said, people are celebrating Joe Biden's win. It seems like it's that part of the movie where you think you've overcome this horrific thing, when in fact it was just, that was the appetizer compared to the main course, if you would. And the bigger thing is coming. I again feel that dread. This was the warm-up, ladies and gentlemen. I keep telling you, there is a civil war, and maybe cold civil war, brewing against or amongst the elite. You've seen it in the moves that they've made against one another. You've seen it in the actions they have asked the Congress, the government, to take on their behalf. And for somebody like Tom Steyer, you see it in his rhetoric, to an extent, if I could say it like that. Something else is coming. Locking these people up, acting like that's going to stop this, it's not. Because it's not going to stop it. It can't. This thing has been bubbling up for so long. They don't know how deep it goes. I don't know. You don't know. There's questions that just have not been answered yet, and they probably won't be for a long time because people don't really want to know the answer. This is the respite, and it's a good respite. We need it. What I would tell my progressive friends, as I'm getting to the end here, get ready. Because Twitter, Facebook, the like, you have a bunch of libertarians, and I keep telling you, libertarianism is just fascism. You guys do not believe me. Watch. A lot of your Silicon Valley executives and things, they're libertarians. They believe in cooperatives for themselves. They don't believe in cooperatives and unions for you. But these people are going to be coming down on some of the lesser-known intellectual leaders in order to allow people like Steve Schmidt and the Lincoln Project to flourish as the new intellectual leaders of the left. They're not going to go after the blue checks. They're not going to go after the Republicans fronting as Democrats. By the way, read the book Rule and Ruin, R-U-L-E and Ruin. If you really want to know what a progressive is. Anyway. There's more to come. I don't know what it is, but I still have that feeling that this isn't over. That, you know, people who are downplaying this movement, they don't get it. They don't understand that this thing has been cultivated now for, as what's his name, Frank Schaefer said, this thing goes back to the 70s. This ain't disappearing overnight. For the, you know, 10% of Trump people, if it's even 10%, maybe it's more like 2, who are going to get a lot of publicity because they've changed their mind, they've questioned what they've been told, things like that. For every person that you're seeing, who's doing that? There's another 100 people that have become silent. They're not going away. They've just become silent. I witnessed this during the Obama era. And I'm witnessing it again. They believe they are right. In fact, no, it goes beyond that. They know they're right. They know that it is their responsibility through bloodshed, if necessary, to save their country. This is why it's so important that Joe Biden heed this historical moment. The amount of people who are going to be willing to back them, The amount of people that are going to be willing to back them will be in proportion to the amount of people that are left behind. That's what it's going to be. If Joe Biden takes a Herbert Hoover approach to all this, well, you know, we got to spend money, but we want to really get Republicans on board, so we're going to do a lot of stuff that pleases their donors and what have you. You're going to set up a reality, which people are all looking at the midterms and saying, oh, that's when the bloodbath is going to be. No, it's not. It's going to be in the next presidential election. Why? Because you're going to have a lot of hard right fascistic candidates running who can talk like Trump, but who can do a whole heck of a lot better in running the country into the ground than Trump does or did. And some of these people will not hesitate to take the same approach that Trump did at the end of his term. And this is concerning. People do not understand, especially those in power, the pain that's out here. Joe Biden can ameliorate that. My concern is that all these special interests and what have you are not going to let him. And they're not going to let him by simply exerting power on the Democratic Party structure. Now, to my, quote, progressive friends, to my radical friends all around the country, and even to my sensible conservatives, because like I keep telling people, conservatism has a lot in common with progressivism. You need to mount up. Yes, there may be some dark days ahead, but the sun is only going to shine because our generation takes over. And that's what needs to be aimed towards. 2022 should be a year that progressives capture more seats in the Congress, that they capture more seats throughout state houses, that they capture more seats on legislatures or city councils, town boards, and what have you. That's the true prophecy. For the coming 10 years, there's going to be a generational shift. And it's not, the ball is no longer in conservatives' court. Everything they've been saying is lies. And people are starting to note that. Oh man, I'm trying to think of who it was who said it. I think it was on Democracy Now, but I can't remember who she was talking to. Either way, Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman was talking to somebody, and they were saying how the religious right, or excuse me, not the religious right, the right wing, when they start to figure out that their arguments no longer are bearing fruit, they often resort to violence to maintain power. Again, they're no longer in the driver's seat. They know the car that they've stolen has been stolen back. They know that. Let me end it there, because I could keep going. I could keep going. And I just looked down and was like, oh, 55 minutes. We're at the end of this thing. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, y'all. Joe Biden, please, 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 please. I may not support you 100%. You know, the Venezuela thing, quickly, sorry guys, I do have to say this. The Venezuela thing is cowardly. I've mentioned it before and I'll mention it again. Everybody likes to talk about Dr. King, but they thought that he was just talking symbolic when he said the arc of the moral universe is long but it bends towards justice. We have entered a period of time. It is a time period where justice is reigning. It's not just a moment where it just kind of flashes in the pan and goes away. No, the arc, which he talked about, entered justice at the beginning of this decade. It's possible that it started in 2019, but definitely at the beginning of this decade. And it's going to be with us for the next 40 to 80. I thought it was going to be 60, but I was looking at some planetary stuff. 40 to 80 years. That's going to completely refocus this country and this world. If the response by the country and the world is abysmal, oh, Mother Nature has something. Mother Nature has something. The Nile has never, well, it's been a long time, but hasn't dried up in a long time. I would just say, neither has the Mississippi. Do not make Mother Nature prove her power. Now I'm done. Questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Fire Mary Deese. And a country is driven. I'll see you on the next one. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom. And we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.